from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. For his 80th birthday, the Dalai Lama invited Archbishop Desmond Tutu to talk about joy and the state of the world today.
The world is often a difficult place, full of fear and anger and suffering. But it is important to see that love and joy also fill our world.
Publisher Doug Abrams was a fly on the wall for those talks, and he turned them into a book called The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. He'll join us to talk about the wisdom the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop shared. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. With a civil war that trapped tens of thousands of civilians in Aleppo, anger between police and communities of color over the fatal shootings of unarmed black men, and the election of Donald Trump flaming tensions across the country, 2016 has not been an easy year. So where do you find joy amidst all the chaos? Let's turn to the experts on joy, His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and book publisher Doug Abrams visited them recently when they had a week of conversation about the state of the world for the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday at his home in Dharamsala. Doug Abrams moderated these conversations and turned them into a publication, The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World, now a bestseller. And while the Dalai Lama and Archbishop are not here, Doug Abrams is, and he'll share his advice that he picked up from these two spiritual icons. Welcome back to Forum, Doug.
Great to be here with you.
Good to have you here. Let's talk, first of all, about what these two extraordinary icons bring to the table. I mean, a lot of personal oppression and challenges in terms of suffering and a good deal of exile, particularly in Tutu's case, but I mean, particularly in Dalai Lama's case, but also in Desmond Tutu's case. So joy comes out of that in many ways, doesn't it? It comes out of suffering.
It's quite incredible, actually. I think the book is really about how do we experience joy in the face of adversity and suffering. And I think when I went into the book, I was envisioning that joy and sorrow are really quite separate. But I think what they teach us is, in fact, that it's like the light in the shadows, that the sorrow is actually what reminds us of the joy. And the more we actually face our own suffering and the suffering of the world, the more our capacity for joy increases.
That's like comedy and tragedy. I
yes.
mean, there's a very thin line, and I think it's probably true that the more sorrow you have, unfortunately, maybe the more you can experience the intensity of joy. Although it's not a recommendation for sorrow.
No,
I don't want any confusion on that. Talk about their relationship, though. I mean, these are two men who enormously admire each other and are enormously admired, of course. But how did they get along famously, really?
Yeah, they call each other their spiritual, mischievous spiritual brother. And they've only met, actually, about a half dozen times. Global leaders don't really get a lot of time to hang out with their buddies. But they do just love each other. That was the most magical and surprising part of the entire week that we got to spend together, was just seeing their incredible love for each other, their affection, their humor. I mean, they were really as funny as a comedy duo, and it was really quite extraordinary.
Well, there were some magical things that happened. I mean, Tutu dancing, for example, and
yes, actually, so it was the. It was the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday was the occasion that we brought Archbishop Tutu to Dharamsala for the dialogues on joy. And the Dalai Lama danced for the first time in his life.
I'm sorry, I said Tutu. I meant
yes,
Dalai
well,
Lama.
Well,
thank
Tutu's
you.
African, so he dances a lot. And he was at this amazing birthday celebration that we had for the Dalai Lama. He's despite the fact that he has this prohibition of being a Tibetan Buddhist monk and not being able to dance, to Tutu got up as this incredibly powerful moment, and as the band of this school, which we can talk about as well, was playing, and he was kind of boogieing, and he's all elbows, and the Dalai Lama was just kind of standing there, and Arch was having none of it, and so he taught him some dance steps, and the Dalai Lama was about as comfortable as a junior high school boy at his first dance, but he did shuffle and shimmy and a little jazz hands as well.
We should mention that Arch is the name that Desmond Tutu has had conferred upon him.
Yes, exactly. That's his affectionate name.
What I meant to say is that the Dalai Lama actually taught you and the Archbishop to meditate, and actually Desmond Tutu gave the Dalai Lama communion?
Yes. Yeah, it was quite incredible. They shared their practices and their traditions with each other, the Dalai Lama taught us to meditate, talked about his meditation practice, talked to us about a kind of daily death meditation that he does, speaking of death. He also received communion from Archbishop Tutu, which was obviously a little controversial but on both sides. But I mean, this is the kind of thing, you know, that the Dalai Lama said, you know, well, I will drink wine, even though, again, he's prohibited from drinking wine as a monk, but I won't be drunk. You know, I can guarantee it. And Tutu said, well, I won't let you drink and drive no matter what. So, I mean, they kind of were bantering back and forth like that the whole time.
They could go on the road as a human.
They could. They really were.
And humor is a big part of course, of joy. I'm a great believer in that as well, as you know. But
yes.
So are kindness and compassion in terms of what came out of this conversation,
yeah,
leading to joy. And, you know, you have just a few obstacles, fear, stress, anger, grief, illness, death. But nevertheless, you can find joy. And what I was struck by was, I mean, here are these two spiritual icons, these two moral leaders, and they're really communing in a way about the source of happiness. And maybe we should distinguish between happiness and joy.
Sure.
But the source of joy, let's call it, is from the inside. It's not from the outside. In other words, it's more of what you draw from within yourself than what people think they can get from material goods or from possessions or acquisitions and so forth.
Exactly. Really, the difference between joy and happiness is, you know, happiness is so often conditional on our achieving things or attaining things. When I get that job, when I fall in love, then I'll be happy. Joy is really this inner state. One of the fascinating things was that the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Tutu were really adamant about the fact that they didn't want this to be a Buddhist book or a Christian book. They wanted it to be universal human book, and they wanted it to really draw on the science as well as their own traditions and their own teachings. And so when we went to the scientists, they basically told us there are four fundamental human emotions. There's fear, there's anger, there's sadness, and there's joy. So when we're talking about joy, we're really talking about, I mean, as you can tell, three of those are what we often call negative emotions or emotions that trouble us. And so really what we were dealing with was, how do you deal with those emotions and how do you cultivate more joy? How do you fundamentally take something that so many of us experience as a kind of fleeting emotion, a fleeting state, and turn it into a kind of character trait, as a default, as these two men have? I mean, here are two men, as you said, who've experienced exile and oppression, enormous personal hardship, enormous communal hardship, and yet their default response to life is to laugh, you know, to find joy even in the face of enormous adversity and sorrow.
I think, and there's a lot of neuroscience in this, the Dalai Lama, I know his work with Dan Goleman and others who have, tried to put these things together, just like putting Christianity and Buddhism together, like they try to do. There's a sense, though, in the talk about lasting joy. I mean, lasting joy means, I guess, enduring joy. And yet, when you think of Buddhism, you think of suffering and you think of flux and impermanence more than anything that's lasting.
Right. I mean, it is. I mean, that's one of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism, is about impermanence. But actually, I think the Dalai Lama would say that that's part of, you know, that perspective. And, you know, we talk in the book about what they described as the eight pillars of joy. And the first one is called perspective. The third one is humor, but the first one is perspective. And it's a kind of fundamental orientation to life of having this wider perspective where you're able to see, yes, the impermanence of life, the transitional nature of life, the wider frame of life, get out of your own limited perspective. And kind of, I think, part of what locks us so often in sorrow, which is not to say that we don't go through the valley of sorrow and experience it, but kind of where we set up camp there is when we get fixated on the pain or the trauma or the adversity in a way that allows us to, that doesn't allow us to try, to go
beyond.
Grief
can be overwhelming, though.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
We were talking about that in the last hour about end of life questions, which are often not even broached. But what I came away with here also was a lot of it, I think, has to do with set points. I mean, there are people who look at the glass half full and people who look at the glass half empty. These are two men who have a real remarkable spirit about them and to them. And, you know, I think I was mentioning to you at one point before we went on the air about these Rinpoches who I had in the studio here.
Yeah.
They were giggling and laughing, and they were just so high spirited. It suggests a kind of set point to me.
Yeah, well, I think that the happiness research, if you can call it that, and the neurological research, the older research suggests a kind of set point that we all kind of have a temperamental kind of default. But I think the more recent research suggests that there really is a lot that we can do to shift our set point or to shift, you know, our range, if you will. You know, we might have kind of a temperamental default, but that doesn't mean that that's, you know, that biology is destiny in any ultimate way.
Well, when you talk about all this happiness research, and there is a lot of it,
yeah.
The wisdom that comes from this conversation from these two remarkable men is don't chase after it.
Right. Well, that's a really important point, is that you can't really pursue happiness in the way that our forefathers set out. Archbishop Tutu says that's the fastest way to miss the bus. Actually, you cultivate these eight pillars of joy that they discuss and present. And just, it might be useful to say, in the book, we tried to, you know, kind of divide it into three parts. The first part was on the nature of true joy, which was what we were talking about before, is, you know, what is joy? How does joy, what's the difference between a kind of listening to a good song and having a kind of general equanimity or joyfulness in one's life? And what are the various degradations of that? And then the obstacles to joy that you were mentioning, everything from fear and stress and anger all the way to suffering, illness, and death. And then ultimately these eight pillars of joy that they think are the real practices that you need to cultivate to have more joy in your life.
And often, again, it gets back to the hardships that you endure. You know, I couldn't help thinking about Hemingway, who says, you know, you get broken in life, you have to heal in those places, but you have to go on. It's very sense of stoicism, where here we're talking about maybe more of a celebration when you have those moments that you can be in the moment and savor and cherish.
There was one incredible moment right at the beginning of the dialogues where the Dalai Lama was talking about his 50 years of exile. And Archbishop Tutu said to him, you know, like, how are you not morose? And of course, the Dalai Lama didn't know the word morose, so he turns to his translator to get a translation. And Archbishop Tutu says, sad. Why are you not sad? Here you've been turfed out of your country for 50 years. Could there be anything more, you know, tragic and painful than that? And the Dalai Lama actually said, I prefer the last, you know, 50 years of exile. And, you know, it wasn't that he was saying, you know, kind of excusing or dismissing the suffering that he's experienced or that his people have experienced, but he was able to say that actually he's gotten closer to life and that than he would have in the gilded cage that he was living in Dharamsala. And so I think it's, you know, we diminish it by saying it's a kind of half empty or half full way of looking at life, but it's really the ability, and this is actually what the happiness researchers talk about, is the ability to reframe negative experiences into a more positive light. What Archbishop Tutu says, do you let your suffering embitter you or ennoble you? And, I mean, he gives the example of Nelson Mandela's 27 years in prison and how that experience didn't embitter Nelson Mandela, it ennobled him. He was able to find meaning in his suffering and to use that meaning to be of benefit to himself and to others.
We're talking with Douglas Abrams, co-author of the book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World, written with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He's also the founder, Doug Abrams is, of Idea Architects, a book and media company. How do I say it? Desmond Tutu. Say that name right. Let me talk with you a bit, if I could, though, about the suffering of others. I mean, so much of joy is tied to compassion, and mm-hmm. one can feel joy. We learned from these two elders and wise men through being compassionate and exercising mm-hmm. compassion. But you read the newspapers, and there's so much suffering, I mean, in the world. And if you internalize that, if you're a sensitive person and, you know, you care about other people and, above all, are compassionate, how does one get from that to joy?
Well, it's a great question, and actually it's the question that we most received. We went out to the world. We had a couple of days to gather questions before we went to Dharamsala, and we got over 1,000 questions. And the question that was most asked was exactly the question that you're asking, which is, not how do I have more joy in my own life, but how do I experience joy in a world so filled with suffering? And we put that question to them. And I think what, you know, here are two men who ultimately feel the pain of the world quite profoundly, who are extraordinarily compassionate, as you said. But what they said was, you have to be able to take that wider perspective. You have to see the longer sweep of human history, not just an election cycle. You have to look at
what, like Martin Luther King called, trajectory going towards something more moral.
Yes,
and better.
The moral arc of the universe. Yeah. And you have to also recognize that the news is this aberration of what's actually mostly happening on planet Earth. You know, most of the interactions on planet Earth are loving and kind and compassionate. They said, talked about how parents loving their children are in hospitals, where Archbishop Tutu has unfortunately recently been all too much. You know, the kind of kindness and compassion and caring that is happening from one individual to another.
A lot of parents beat their children and, you know, flock their children.
That is true, but that is the aberration. I mean, I think that's, you know, why it's so distressing to us. And this is one of the things that Archbishop Tutu comes back to quite a bit, is if it were normal, it wouldn't disturb us. If it was, you know, the real horror would be if it didn't move us to be. And I think when you see real moral aberration, it's because people have normalized what ultimately is aberrant human behavior.
So there's a belief in essentially both of them, probably, in the goodness and the humanity of humanity itself.
Yeah, I think that you know, as Archbishop Tutu said, you know, it takes time to become human, and that. But fundamentally, we are made to be good. We are fundamentally social animals that really require and need one another. What Archbishop Tutu often refers to as Ubuntu, and so that fundamental need for one another, that kind of. The fact that as mammals, as we are raised with with mother love, that is the basis for the kind of compassion that we extend towards others.
Well, here are Archbishop Tutu and the Dalai Lama. We have a clip of them talking about why people are inherently good and can bring about their own joy.
We are fundamentally good. The aberration is not the good person. The aberration is the bad person.
People who see newspaper, too much believe that one only event on this planet, then feel more hopelessness and feel humanity is bad and our future not much hope. Yes, there are very sad things, very negative things, but at the same time, there are much more positive things.
People are fundamentally generous. You and you and you and you have the potential to be instruments of incredible compassion and forgiveness.
And this reminds me of the idea that's put forth that we are making ourselves into a masterpiece or something mm-hmm. along those lines, but an intrinsic basic belief, an inherent belief in the goodness of human beings. So I'm somewhat reluctant to use a theological heavy word, but where does evil fit into this?
Well, I think they would say that you know, evil is real, I would think they would say that we
do. Is it human too?
Yes. I mean, I think we do, you know, great evil. I mean, I think they would have different theologies or different understandings of it from a Buddhist perspective or a Christian perspective. But I do think that ultimately, I mean, maybe the easiest thing to say is, or the best thing to refer to Archbishop Tutu talks about how we, you know, from a kind of divine, you know, they joked a lot about, you know, who believes in God and who doesn't believe in God, and therefore who's going to the warmer place and who's not, you know. That was one of the kind of jokes that they played with all week long. But this idea that we, you know, that Archbishop Tutu talks about, that if you do believe in God, that we are those hands of God. You know, we are, you know, the ones who, so it doesn't matter whether you kind of have a divine view that we are the hands of God, or you believe that it's kind of the wrestling within our own human psyche between our, you know, our positive and negative impulses. But ultimately, we are the ones who determine whether evil stands or whether evil is done or whether we are able to, you know, apply the eight pillars of joy in our life and in our world.
So talk about the eight pillars of joy. I mean, you mentioned perspective and you mentioned humor. And
yes.
They're divided into head and heart, aren't they? Four each?
Yes. So there are four pillars of the heart, four pillars of the mind and four pillars of the heart. It starts with perspective, which we discussed. And the second is humility. And the third is humor. And the fourth is acceptance. And it's important to explain that acceptance is not acquiescence. So that's, I mean, here are two of the
Nor great, resignation.
It's not resignation, right. Yeah. It's these are two of the great social justice activists of our era who, you know, have marshaled, you know, fire and brimstone against evildoers. So, and particularly in Archbishop Tutu's case. So this is not about, but it's, you know, that chapter's on acceptance. The, you know, reality is the only place from which real change can occur. Then the four pillars of the heart are forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity.
And certainly when you look at, and I had the privilege of interviewing the Archbishop many years ago, but we talked about, you know, forgiveness in terms of crimes of apartheid and of the South African regime. And,
yeah,
you know, he very much believed in that and stood behind it in ways that a lot of people obviously can't or won't. So there you get into kind of more the perspectives of how things are framed and how humanity looks at things. We're talking with Douglas Abrams, and we're talking about how two really extraordinary figures of our time, both in their 80s, both Nobel laureates, and both certainly major icons, look at the idea of joy. And the idea of joy is tied to so many things. It's tied, as we've said, to compassion. It's not just joie de vivre, you know, just
right.
Celebrating life in terms of some Epicurean or Bacchanalian way. It's more the experience of joy that comes out of often feelings of suffering. Let me bring our listeners into this. I know many of you may want to weigh in with your own thoughts, and it's a philosophical discussion, but it's also a deep discussion about life itself and approaches to life, and I'd like to hear from you. If you have something you'd like to add to the conversation, you can join us now at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. We invite your phone calls, so feel free to be part of the program. The number again to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Please feel free also to go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. The book again is The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. And our guest is Douglas Abrams. He's the founder of Idea Architects, a book and media company. We'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Douglas Abrams, and I always find it hard to object to or certainly avoid a good joke. There was one about a Jew, a Christian, and a Buddhist walking into the Himalayas and coming out with this book. Douglas Abrams is with us. His book is called The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. I want to talk about joy and forgiveness. And here are Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama talking about why it's important to forgive and not hold on to your anger.
Almost natural response is when I'm hit, I hit back. When you have been refined, you put yourself in the shoes of the other.
It is totally wrong. The practice of tolerance and practice of forgiveness is signs of weakness. Totally wrong. 100% wrong. Or 1,000% wrong. Isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean,
this is forgiveness. It's the sign of strength. Isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes, I was just going to say those who say forgiving is a sign of weakness haven't tried it.
It's a wonderful line, and it brought laughter, as you can hear. Those who say forgiving is a sign of weakness haven't tried it. I mean, it's noble to think in terms of forgiveness. I always use the example when somebody cuts me off and I honk the horn and then they give me the gesture, I want to go after them. I'm
right.
Sorry, but that's
right.
That's the visceral response that it's hard to reframe. Let me read some comments that are coming in here. Daniel writes, Archbishop Tutu and the Dalai Lama are joyful voices. Others I would recommend on the subject of joy include Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, Trappist monk Thomas Merton, Franciscan priest Richard Rohr, and Pope Francis. Also, to nurture and express more joy day to day makes a great New Year's resolution. Daily joy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. You write about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, there's this great, when we first arrived in Dharamsala, we had lunch together, and Archbishop Tutu told this wonderful story about how one of the first times they were together, they were lined up as Nobel recipients, kind of in order of age, and the Dalai Lama was behind Archbishop Tutu, and he this man of compassion and peace starts choking Archbishop Tutu, and Archbishop Tutu turns around and says, "Hey, man, the cameras are on us. Act like a holy man." Which, I mean, I think was, their wonderful, humorous way of saying that, you actually, even holy men have to act like holy men. That, these things that we think are, just like we are this way are actually daily practices. And one of the things, the book was envisioned as a kind of three-layer birthday cake for the world. There was their teachings and their incredibly intimate stories that they told from their own lives, which I think was one of the unique things about this project, was because they were talking to each other, they really shared their humanity. They weren't on a mountaintop preaching or teaching. They were really sharing, these two.
There's an intimacy between them. It comes across in the book.
Yeah,
a bond.
Intimacy and bond. And then, the second layer was the, kind of the travelogue of the experience. So we really wanted to be able to take the whole world to Dharamsala with us and have them experience what it's like to, be taught to meditate by the Dalai Lama or dance with the Dalai Lama, or have these kind of break bread and, have the Dalai Lama, who's supposed to be kind of detached from physical pleasures, turn to you and say, with a bowl of rice pudding, "I love this," which was, wonderful. And then the third layer was the science that we were alluding to before. But the kind of the icing on the cake was really they're sharing their joy practices. And I think one of the things, to come back to your question about how do we deal with so much of the suffering in the world, is you can't just, the metaphor that Archbishop Tutu uses is you have to deal with it like a dishwasher, not a vacuum cleaner. You can't actually suck up all the dirt and all the pain and just hold on to it. You actually have to have practices that allow you to process that pain and that anguish and let go of it.
When you talk about mental immunity, I mean,
yes,
you have to kind of protect yourself. It's like when you get a cold,
Yes.
He used that metaphor, I think.
Yes, the Dalai Lama is a big exponent of what he calls mental immunity. And he says just how you have physical immunity that protects you from colds or, in your health, in your body, you need to have mental immunity, which are these practices and these ways. The eight pillars of joy are a perfect example. When you cultivate those, then you're less likely to have the reaction that you were describing when somebody cuts you off in traffic. I mean, one of the reasons I it's funny that you say that, because really, I think the reason I really wanted to work with Archbishop Tutu initially, I've had the privilege of working with him for over a decade on his books, was actually, you know, not just that he was a towering figure and hero from the anti-apartheid movement in college, but I really wanted to know, how does somebody who's such a moral leader and a spiritual master drive in traffic? And so we were actually together in Florida one of the first times we met, and we were driving in traffic. Somebody cut him off in traffic, and you know, his response was, you know, there are some amazing people, you know. And I said, so, okay, so what, you know, I was actually interviewing him as we were driving. And I was like, okay, so what just went through your head? You know, what were you just thinking? And how did you, you know, like, and he said, well, maybe that guy is on his way to the hospital because his wife is sick. You know,
it's a brilliant way to frame it, to, you know, get rid of your anger, or at least spread it out. And I've used that technique. I suppose we all have it, because, you know, it doesn't do you much good to get enraged, and it can only eat away at you. Let me go to our callers and let's see what they have to say and add to this discussion. We go first to you, Deborah. You're on the air.
Hi, my name is Deborah. I'm calling from Berkeley. And I wanted to comment, first of all, thank you, all of you, for talking about this topic, because as an adult, I feel like it's almost like an aberration. You're talking about aberration, you know, that bad people are the aberration. But I think that sometimes joyful people are the aberration, even though people are good. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of permission in our society to express our joyfulness. And I was mentioning that I suffer from MS, from multiple sclerosis, and I've been disabled for about 6 years, and I had to stop working and give up a really great career and all that kind of stuff. And I actually have discovered that my life is much more joyful now, because I don't have to, you know, be so doing the right thing all the time. And I can make a lot more mistakes, and I can laugh at myself a lot more than I could before. And the other thing about this is that I feel like I've been able to really revisit the kind of state of being that I was in as a child. I had a really difficult childhood, but I managed to sort of protect myself from the difficulties by kind of being out of reality, as many children are, and just sort of making up my own fun things and my own joyful things to sort of cope with difficulties. And I do that now. I feel like I've become more childish, and I can really, you know, enjoy my life a lot more. And about, you know, the traffic, when people cut me off in traffic, or I've actually cut somebody off in traffic because I'm confused and I get to the wrong place, and I've actually stopped at the light, and they're like giving me a terrible look, and they're getting ready to, you know, give me the gesture, and I roll down my window and I say, I am so sorry. I'm a little confused. I don't know exactly where I'm going, and I really appreciate the fact that you didn't, you know, scream at me or beep at me or whatever, and I'm so sorry. And like, they're like, oh, okay, sure, go ahead, you know. And so just being able to be sillier and more childish and more naive and give people the benefit of the doubt has helped me be happier.
Well, you've said a good deal there, Deborah, and I'm really appreciative for your call. She said childish, but I think childlike might be more what we're talking about. There's something childlike about Tutu and the Dalai Lama, but there's also, she brings up the real quandary of physical pain. I mean, multiple sclerosis, or, you know, people can feel so locked into their bodies that to get out of their bodies and experience joy becomes sometimes almost impossible.
Yeah. And
Deborah's inspiring. But,
yeah, you know, incredible. Deborah, thank you so much for your call and your comments. And I actually think we need to talk. We talk about illness and suffering, physical suffering, in the book quite a bit, because Archbishop Tutu is dealing with prostate cancer and has spent a lot of time in hospitals. He had TB, he had polio. But I do think that her point is a really good one, which is that sometimes we are quick, you know, we think it is being childish to be joyful, or naive, or somehow you're not seeing reality with sober eyes, or, you know, seeing clearly all the suffering that exists. And I think that what Deborah is referring to is really a powerful reminder of, actually, you know, it's almost like we have a fear of being considered naive. But when you actually are experiencing suffering, it's often very liberating to recognize that you can find joy, you know, even in your greatest fears. And I think, you know, I often think I've had the privilege of working with a lot of extraordinary scientists and a lot of extraordinary spiritual masters. And I often think there's this kind of universal laughter index of spiritual development, you know, the ability to laugh at yourself and have a sense of humor. That's really an incredible example of what spiritual life can bring to you in daily practices, as we were talking about.
Yeah, and let me thank Deborah for that call. Because I wrote a book that has a title of has the word laughter in the title, I've discovered, you know, from a lot of people calling my attention to it, how much a lot of this bears more careful scrutiny and empiricism. But, you know, laughter being actually a way of reducing stress, laughter being a way of and there's joy in laughter, of course, but also,
yeah,
as you point out, but also being possibly even healing. I mean, yeah, cardiovascular, other systems, endocrine system and so forth. We need more data, but there's a lot that suggests that. We also need more calls, so let's hear what Julia has to say next. Julia, you're on.
Hi, good morning. I don't want to be a Grinch, but I have to say this all strikes me as very false and hollow, because two guys who have enormously benefited from all of the quote-unquote suffering they've endured and lived lives of enormous privilege talking to us about joy in very cliché terms. Sounds like a lot of pablum that's been generated to make some money for the Christmas holidays, and it sounds extremely cynical. I'm here in the Bay Area where there's lots of joyful people. Joy is easy. Go down the street two blocks from where I am and look at all the people living on the freeway, under the freeway in tents. Do we do anything about that? Not really, because we don't really care that much. So are we good? We're fundamentally good. All of this stuff, all of these little homilies that come out, you know, we've heard them 1,000 times before. We know them. And most of us do not go off at each other in traffic. You know, that, why that example? It seems ridiculous. I mean, most of us are very contained and respectful of one another anyway.
Well, you're saying, so, I think if you you can experience joy from the standpoint of privilege, that's a good point. But also, it doesn't necessarily make you mindful of who's suffering under the bridge, or, you know, who's homeless and so forth. And I wonder, Doug, if you could shed some light on that. I understand where Julia's coming from.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Julia's concern is a legitimate one, and that's why the book is not about some kind of don't worry, be happy pablum, as she said. It's really about how do we experience, you know, well-being and joy and happiness in the face of the realities in our life and in the realities of our world, which actually I think there's a false dichotomy that a lot of well-meaning progressives or liberals, you know, kind of have, where that if they're really cynical and really bitter and angry, that somehow they're going to bring more justice to the world. And there is definitely a role for righteous indignation and anger. But actually, I think that the kind of cynicism and lament that Julia is referring to actually leads many people, maybe not Julia, but many people to a kind of paralysis, that, you know, a kind of, it doesn't actually result in people, you know, going and trying to do something for those who are homeless under the freeway.
Well, we're talking about two iconic figures who have done a great deal for people that they've come in contact with. Julia, I mean, let's give the concession where it belongs. These are two men who've done remarkable things for others.
Yeah, I think that that's a really important point. That, I mean, you know, it might be pablum if it were just, you know, a kind of Hallmark card of sorts. But when you're dealing with two men who have devoted their life to social justice and to the causes of their people, I think you would hardly say that their insight on the validity and the ability to be joyful is pablum.
Although, on the other hand, now here's Mark who writes, let me thank Julia for the call. I'm constantly amazed with the blind reverence the West gives to leaders such as the Dalai Lama. He has marginally improved the lives of average Tibetans through some reforms. This small benefit pales in comparison with the comfort and wealth he has accrued over his life. Tibet remains a desperately poor nation, yet the Dalai Lama lives a blessed life of wealth and prestige.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you know, one can find cynicism, you know, can choose cynicism whenever one, you know, wherever one wants, quite frankly. And to
is it cynicism or skepticism?
Well, I mean, I think it's cynicism, quite frankly. I think skepticism is healthy. I think a kind of default cynicism is not so healthy. I would hardly, you know, yes, the Dalai Lama is a revered leader of his people. I would hardly describe what, you know, him as the, you know, the monk in Gucci shoes that has been, you know, kind of, the criticism that the Chinese and others have kind of forged. But he's a very humble and devoted man who does not live in opulence by any nature. And yes, the Tibetan people are suffering enormously. And a big part of the week that we spent was actually at this extraordinary school called the Tibetan Children's Village, where the children of from Tibet are sent by their parents with guides or relatives as early as age 5 over the mountain passes because they can't get a Tibetan education in Tibet. And they go through these very kind of grueling journeys to get to these schools where they can be educated by the Dalai Lama. And at one of the most extraordinary and moving times of the week, these young people were sharing their stories and their journeys of leaving their families. And you could see, I mean, you know, as they were, you know, trying, you know, they were, as they were sharing these stories of heartbreak, of, you know, they leave their families and their families send them off, you know, knowing they won't see them again for 13 years, if ever. And, you know, they would break down as they, you know, kind of thought about these moments of separation and loss. So, I mean, I think, you know, I think these calls are wonderful in that they're balancing each other's perspectives and they're kind of the varied responses that we can have. And I think that, you know, the Dalai Lama and Tutu are not waving their fingers at anyone and saying you should, you know, be happy. They are saying that here is how we have found the wellsprings of joy in our life. This is how we have had lives of activism and social justice in the face of enormous suffering, and done so from a place not of, you know, judgment and condemnation, but of a place of compassion and inclusion.
But, you know, I often think about that great line of Bertolt Brecht's I quote from time to time, "The man who laughs has not yet been told the terrible news," even though I'm all behind laughter and the importance of laughter in our lives. Here's Patty, who writes, "I love this book mostly because the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop agree that rituals and religions are not nearly as important as love and kindness. And also, I appreciated the discussion of hope versus optimism. Very encouraging, especially during these frightening times. Can you give us a quick sense of the difference between hope and optimism, as you discovered?"
Yeah, this is a really important and powerful refrain that Archbishop Tutu explains, of that he's not an optimist. You know, optimists are people who typically kind of, as you said, maybe it's the default of the glass is half full, or it's a kind of trusting a certain, you know, kind of that things will work out okay, in a way that can quickly become pessimism when the facts change. And what he says is that hope is really a kind of conviction in the possibility of humanity, or the possibility of the future, or if you are religious, the power of God, but it can also be the power of humanity. And that hope, that firm conviction that he has and that many others have, is fundamentally unshakable in a way that a more kind of, less firm optimism might not be.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Barbara in San Anselmo. You're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I want to say that it's very important. This kind of relates to both joy and sadness. But it's very important if you are with someone who is dying, who has chosen to die, had the courage to do it, that you don't hesitate to ask questions. I was so undone by the situation when my sister was dying that I hesitated to ask questions that I should have really asked, and I would encourage anybody in that situation to do that. And regarding happiness, I think happiness and joy are a wonderful part of life. And what my sister said that I found great, as she was dying, she turned to me, I was the younger sister, and she said, "Barb, I'm cashing in my chips." And I thought, good for you. Anyway, Thank you for taking the call.
Thank you for the call, Barbara. Appreciate hearing from you. And we're going to hear from another caller from Oakland. Robert, you're on. Morning. Robert, are you there? That's too bad. He's a psychiatrist who was apparently wanting to know about, he works in prisons and said he's met too many people who seem like just bad seeds. Again, you get into this whole question of evil and where it comes from and so forth. I mean, we could certainly go into hours of trying to explain that here, but let me just go to another caller, and that's Michael from Pleasanton. Michael, you're on.
Good morning. It's eerily coincidental. I literally just wrote an email back to my friend's wife. He passed away, Randy Kite, of ALS, about a year and a half ago. And as he was dying, he said, choose joy. Hmm. And so I think my big message would be on a daily basis is to choose joy, because it is a choice. And with everything going on in the world, it's not a bad thing to do. You can do it, you know, in a little moment, you know, walking through the forest or, you know, having a encounter with a person in a store or whatever it is. But I think that's just a great message of choose joy.
Thank you for that. Thank I appreciate you. Hearing from you, Michael.
I think it's a really wonderful point that Michael makes, that these things are volitional, that they do have choice, that we, you know, often think that our emotional life is just a kind of reaction. And yes, there are responses and feelings that we have, and I think both men honored those. But then there is a response and a choice and a freedom that we have of how then we take that initial response of anger or sadness or fear and then what we do with it.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to John. John, you're on.
Hi, good morning. I've run into the situation where I've tried to deal with a person, my immediate next-door neighbor, who does nothing but bring up the negative things that have happened in the past. And I've tried to ask her to see if she could move on, not think in negative terms, but try to remember the more positive things that happened. And she seems to be extremely happy, which is, of course, ironic, bringing up past negative events, and she does not want to be pried loose of that. And
she wants her suffering, huh?
I mean, she takes every chance to bring up something negative. Even if you started out talking about something completely different, she injects a negative thing that occurred. And then even if you personally help her out, the next time she brings it up again. And refuses to remember the good things, and you feel like, I mean, it really affects me, and I'm not even the person suffering with that.
She bums you out, as we used to say. I understand that, yeah. We need a name for that. We have Pollyanna. We need, you know, the opposite of Pollyanna.
Right.
But there are people like that. Doug, you have some thoughts from you?
Well, I think that's why the first pillar of joy is perspective, because fundamentally you can filter any good through a negative lens, or you can, you know, transform any negative experience should you wish. The Dhammapada, which is one of the sacred Buddhist texts, talks about the fact that we make the world with our mind. And so here is a woman who clearly is making a certain kind of world through her perspective and through her mind. She might benefit from a copy of the book.
And everything confirms that in her mind, even if it's good stuff. Thanks for bringing that up, John. Appreciate hearing from you. You're getting some very tough questions here. How can people today, with the rise of nationalism and fear-mongering, find the capacity for compassion and goodness in people who seem to lack a moral compass?
Yeah, really important question. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny. The book has been called kind of the antidote to the election or the antidote to the times. And I think in many ways it really cuts to the heart of what so many of us are struggling with, which is, you know, how do we go beyond despair? How do we go beyond a sense of, you know, outrage and anger at what's happening? And how do we find our way through that? And I think, you know, ultimately, I think what Archbishop Tutu and the Dalai Lama would say is they'd come back to a sense of shared humanity, that, you know, there's really not a lot that we can achieve by. And I think you see this in our divided politics in America, where, you know, it's kind of like we denigrate and dismiss the other perspectives in such a way that we've lost our civil dialogue, and everybody loses in that. So I think the challenge is, yes, it's very hard sometimes to look at whether it's somebody who one perceives as a bad seed in jail, or whether one looks at a leader who is perpetrating evil.
Somebody even brought up SS Nazis, you know, and that sort of thing. I mean, you know, dealing with that, as some people have to, or just as you live a life exposed to that kind of evil all the time.
Right. And I think the valid point is, you know, that that's why acceptance is not, you know, acquiescence or resignation. It's not to say, well, you know, because we accept the reality of an election or a world that we live in, that somehow it's okay and that we don't fight with tooth and nail to make it different than it is.
Let me try to get another caller on, and that's Mark. Mark, join us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very quickly. I'm 47, and in my intentioned journey for maximizing joy in my life, I talk to other people about it and what their thoughts are. You know, to a person, everybody says that the older they get, the more joyful they are. And I surmise a number of things from that, including it's knowing thyself. When you can get to know yourself better as you get older, you then know what brings you joy. For example, when I was young, for me, it was the acquisition of things, the latest gadget. I thought that was what made me happy. And of course, now I'm completely disinterested in things at all and more interested in doing for others, just as a small example. And these two icons that you mentioned, Michael, as you point out, are in their 80s. So they have had time to figure this out, and as also hopefully we all will. And I think that may be the journey.
I think that's well said, and I thank you for that, Mark. I mentioned the other day I went to the 85th birthday party of a woman who was full of joy, Rita Moreno, and she says it's the happiest time of her life, you know, the most joyful time
that's
of her
awesome.
Life. And sometimes that can be the result of a lot of the aggression and a lot of the seeking of happiness and everything, just being facing reality. Mm-hmm. And Doug, good to have you on. Thank you.
Michael,
congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate your being with us. Douglas Abrams' new book, again, is The Book of Joy, co-authored with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Thank you for being a part of this morning's Forum program. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Engineer is Katie McMurrin. Engagement editor is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer, Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.